Once again, this session is entitled Recent Advances in Photograph Preservation from the Image Permanence Institute. My colleague Ryan Boatwright and I will both be presenting. IPI, for those of you, the Image Permanence Institute, for those of you who don't know about what we have many different areas of research, and we're very active, and Jim Riley, the director, has always been very focused on the creation of didactic resources for the cultural heritage fields. These include long-term work on environmental monitoring, which he's very active in these days, as well as current work on the deterioration and care of digital prints, which is kind of a research project that's just underway now and will eventually see some excellent tools, I think, for our fields. And more recently as well, a website for the study and identification of print processes, which Ryan will be presenting on in a moment here. In addition, we do sometimes more specific research. For example, I've been working on kind of a guide to black and white print deterioration over the last couple of years, and I'll be presenting that after Ryan, so kind of from the most general to a very specific topic. We'll take questions at the end of both presentations. We have a lot to cover, so let's get started. Please welcome Ryan Boatwright.
All right. So here is Jim Riley himself at the computer, staring at this wonderful online resource that we've been developing probably over the last 3 years or so. So I'll start off by talking about print characterization a little bit. What is it? For the archival tasks, you must know about the materials in your collection. You must know what kind of photographs you have, when they are made, and you must know how to preserve them. So understanding the special characteristics of different types of prints and photographs is very important in doing this, and will help you answer these questions. Our research at IPI is focused on understanding the print as a physical object, so going beyond just understanding photographs as images, but understanding what they're made out of, how they look, all their physical characteristics is really the goal of our research. And this is useful for many different fields, especially for you guys being archivists. It's very helpful to know what you have. How can IPI help? Well, I'm here today to talk to you about an online resource that we're working on. I'll talk a little bit about visual representation and also about print identification tools, especially one that's currently being developed. And also IPI has many other preservation tools available. I'll pedal this little monitor for a second, but IPI has developed these little data loggers that collect temperature and humidity information, and we've also developed a website that allows you to take the data off of the monitor, and it's more of an analytical website that's for free that comes along with the monitor. So we can talk more about the kind of more of the other activities that IPI is engaged in and the environmental monitoring after the talk if you'd like. But back to visual representation. So here we have what many scholars consider to be the first permanent photograph taken of nature by Niepce. It's a view from the window at Le Gras. And if you type in the first photograph in Google, you get something like this. So this was done a year ago. And you can see that there are many various, very subtle and abrupt differences in the representations that we see on the web. And more so, this is how we understand photography through doing research on the web and looking at images on the web. It's really how we're experiencing our lives these days. In 1952, Helmut Gernsheim requested the research laboratory of the Eastman Kodak Company in England to make a copy of this first photograph, so document it either on a copy stand, or actually on a copy stand. And they used different types of lighting techniques and worked very hard at trying to come up with a good representation of this image. And so here we have the first attempt at this representation. You can see that it's very, very splotchy, has lots of kind of missing pieces of image. Helmut Gernsheim was very dissatisfied by this representation and decided that he would take the project up on by himself and start to work on it. So he ended up using a lot of watercolors to start retouching the image, and he came up with a representation that looked like this. So you can see that it's quite a bit different image here, looking at this picture versus this picture. So this image is really what has been the basis of our understanding of the first photograph for over 50 years, for around 50 years. But what you don't see in this photograph is you don't see that it's an object. And it's an image on pewter. So it's an image on metal. This is a plate. This isn't a paper print. It's not just an image. And it wasn't until 2002 when the Getty decided to re-photograph this plate and come up with a new representation. And so as we can see it now, it looks like an object. You know, this tells the history of photography through this image. And what you're seeing on the screen is you're seeing a pewter plate with an image, and if you notice these little pot marks in the plate, you can see that on the back of the plate there were some nails that were driven into the frame, and so probably at some point they created those dents onto the surface. And this image lives at the Harry Ransom Center in Texas now. And so on their website, you can go and view the picture and look at it in this way. So what they've done is they've photographed it in a way where they've shined specular light down onto the plate to kind of accentuate the metallic nature of the plate. So we have a much better understanding. It's still not great, but it's much better. So the trick is trying to figure out the best ways to photograph and document different processes or different photographs. And so you can take this to the opposite end of the spectrum. And so this is a family photograph of mine. It's a chromogenic print. It's a 4x6 print. And it's one of those pictures when you go through your family photograph collection, you kind of stumble upon it and you feel like you really don't relate to it all. And so I thought it was appropriate to photograph this underneath the microscope many, many times. It's actually 150 photographs. And spliced together like in a grid, but I've done it with a specular illumination again. So when I talk about specular illumination, just think of when you go to the beach on a sunny day at sunset and you look out onto the water, you see all the glints and glares off the surface of the waves, and that really accentuates the topography of that water. Well, this is the same concept that we use in some of our documentary methods at IPI and some of the research we're doing. So this is just that. So the image has been obliterated because of the technique that was used to photograph it. So we can see that we have a dilemma. You know, what are the best ways to document photographs and processes? So we've been working on developing a set of standard imaging techniques for characterization and print identification. And so this involves a microscopy lab where we have copy stands, and microscopes, and we connect cameras to them and have different ways of lighting objects. So I'll go over a few different techniques quickly, and then we'll get on to the web resource where the images for this research is going. So we utilize a typical copy stand. We under low magnification, you can start to understand the object better in terms of you can understand the color of your picture. You know, different paper bases and different images have different colors, essentially. And so using a calibrated means of documenting this, you can really start to understand that, you know, this paper is a little bit creamier than this paper. And this image is warmer than that image, or you can start to think about toning. You know, this is a sulfur tone print, so it has a very, very warm image. And this is very easy when you have the prints right in front of you, but as soon as you start to try to document these and put these onto a web resource, you have to be a little bit more precise about what you're doing. Under high magnification, you can start to see things like the paper fibers of prints and other characteristics like surface cracking. So when we teach about print identification, we often teach about layer structure. And so learning about how a material is made is very important and helps give clue to the processes that you have. Under raking illumination, this is light that's coming from the side of a print, casting shadows on all the small topography of the print, and so it's really accentuating the textural qualities. So not only can you see paper fibers, but you can see other markings that have been made onto the paper. So some prints are made with the texturized roller in the paper making machine, so you can notice that. Under high magnification, you can also see surface cracking again. Axial illumination, this is back to creating this specular reflectance that I just talked about. Under low magnification, you can understand sheen and gloss, image relief. High magnification, you can start to look at surface particles, surface cracking, that sort of thing. And also we're looking at prints and documenting them under UV illumination, and you can start to understand more about optical brighteners, whether or not a paper's been brightened, and a little bit about deterioration. So just as a quick study, a quick example, let's take this is a Kodak darkroom data guide, and it has 11 or 12 different types of silver gelatin papers in it, and we'll use these imaging techniques and look at one particular paper, and that paper is Ectolera paper E. And I'll go through and just articulate a little bit about the characteristics that you're seeing through these images. So up top left, you're seeing the entire print photographed with raking light, so you can begin to understand that, okay, this isn't a really smooth paper. There is a textural quality here. Under 45 degree light, you can learn that, okay, the paper is fairly neutral white. The image is slightly warm. And on the website, you have the ability to compare different printing processes, so it really comes out if you're comparing a warm tone image with something neutral, you have a better understanding. Under axial illumination, you can see how the texture on the surface is disrupting the specular reflectance on the surface, and so it's another way of observing texture, but it also is a way of gauging the amount of sheen, how glossy the picture is. Here we are a little closer, under higher magnification, you can see top left that this paper has a fine grain structure to it, so this was made through a marking roller in the wet press area of the papermaking machine. Under 45 degree illumination, you can start to observe characteristics like image sharpness, so this is important if you're kind of comparing images, and also if you're trying to look at image structure. If you have a print that has a pattern, say like an inkjet print or offset lithograph, you can really start to observe the patterns there, and that becomes very important. So you can really understand the difference between a photograph, something that's continuous tone, versus other types of photomechanical and digital prints that the image is made from a small pattern. Under closer axial illumination, simply seeing the texture and the glare a little bit closer. Even closer, here we see paper fibers. Under the axial illumination, bottom right, we start to see that there are these little tiny rocks on the surface of the paper. So if we go in even closer, we can see that there are these little tiny particles made either from barium sulfate, probably from barium sulfate, and these little pebbles are thrown into the emulsion layer on this print to disrupt that specular reflectance. So it's a way of creating more of a matte paper. So it's kind of our jobs to understand how things are made, what they look like, and through different representations, we can get a fuller, better understanding of what it is we're seeing. We also do cross-sections, so here we are seeing the paper from the side, so we can understand layer structure this way, and in comparison, you can start to compare paper thicknesses. So here we have a fiber-based paper with the baryta layer and, of course, the gelatin silver up top, and same is true with the fluorescence down here, bottom right. We're looking more and more at fluorescence on the surface, so you're seeing on the left, you're seeing an image of this Kodak paper that's been made with tungsten illumination, and on the right, you're seeing exactly the same picture made with tungsten and UV. So you can see that this paper's been brightened slightly, so there's a difference in the way it looks, and it's just because of the UV light that's causing that difference here. So I want to jump into quickly the web interface for the exploration presentation of these characteristics. Right now the database contains around 54 different processes, all sorts of different processes, from pre-photographic materials, so even like prints, etchings, engravings, woodcuts, that kind of thing, through the photomechanical processes and photographic, and now we're looking at digital prints as well. It's called Digital Sample Book. If you guys haven't visited, check it out. So here on the right, we're seeing Saturn's Titan moon, and on the left, it's probably the surface of some other planet. But right now, it's an image database. You can go, you can select different processes, pull up different images that explain the different characteristics and really compare them. So it's kind of this grand database, this image viewer. You can, through this, you can really get down to the nitty-gritty about the materials, as you can see. We're working on a new website that will be called Graphics Atlas, and it's really just an update of the Digital Sample Book resource. And the Graphics Atlas contains essentially Digital Sample Book inside, but it also contains some new functionality that you guys will be very happy about. There's a kind of a portal here that takes you to a page that's tailored for identification, the task of identification. So it kind of guides you through the process of identifying prints. So if you have prints out on a table and you want to know what you have, and you don't have a microtome or a microscope to see cross sections and fluorescence, but you do have a loupe, you know, that's one of your most basic tools, or a low power stereo microscope. Well, the goal of this is to guide you through with those basic images and tools for reference on the web. So this is essentially the Digital Sample Book, now called the Object Explorer. It's where you want to go and look at all the different characteristics of your print. We will have more information specifically about what you see in every single picture and what to look for, and for every process. So that should be really helpful. You know, there's a lot of thinking that goes on with this type of research. What kind of samples are we going to include? How to image these samples? What are the various views? And you know, who's the audience? One thing we want to do with this new website is to bring better context to the samples that we put up. So we not only want to show you what they look like, but tell you more about the prints in a historical context or from a technological standpoint. So how are they made? So you'll have a fuller understanding of different printing processes that can really be beneficial for understanding the diversity of materials that are out there. There's a lot of thinking that must go on having to do with how to search mechanisms on the website. You know, how do you get to a specific process? So we've been working on this hierarchical system of selecting processes through larger process groups. You'll see that up there now. And this feature version of the website, we'd like to be able to search by timeline of major usage. So if you want to see all the, if you know your prints from, say, 1920, it's written 1920 in pencil on the back, then you'll want to select 1920 on the timeline, and it will automatically sort all the processes for you of the major usage of what was going on in the 1920s, so that can be very helpful. So back to the idea of kind of simplifying the characterization suite. So as I mentioned, Digital Sample Book, right now there are 12 different pictures up there. Well, we're planning on making that more into 20 different pictures. So that interface will be changing and growing. But at the same time, we're developing this identification module that's essentially shrinking the amount of pictures. So there's, in the identification module, there will essentially just be four different views that you can see. You'll see the, well, I'll cover that in a second. But along with the four different views on the identification module, there will be different pathways, different methodologies for understanding the characteristics of every single printing process. So this is us being like guides to help you. So a platinum print would deserve different treatment than a photogravure or a collotype or a halftone letterpress. You know, there are certain images that describe important characteristics of these. For example, if you were wanting to distinguish the difference between an albumen print and a matte collodion print, one of the important things you want to do is really understand the surface of the picture. You know, does it have a bright layer? How glossy is the surface? But if you want to know the difference of whether or not you have a photograph and an inkjet print, you don't really want to explore surface because, as you guys know, inkjet prints, there are a million different surfaces, so that can really throw you off. You want to understand whether or not the image is continuous or patterned. And so this identification tool will lead you to through the right pathway and show you the pictures that best help you in that way. So for example, we'll use an albumen print here, and we'll just go through one pathway as if you were in the identification module that's to come. And we're obviously going to always show you a picture of the object, front and back, because this gives you a lot of clue. You know, you want to actually look at the image and understand it and look at the format and the size and in any other bits of information that could provide clue to the context. Secondly, with the albumen print, you really want to understand surface. So I'll get out of PowerPoint for just a second. And so we've been working on these videos that really help you understand surface. So it's closer to our real experience when you actually pull out prints and you're trying to identify them. So this is an albumen print. And what's happening is as it tilts in and out of the light. And you can see that the glare that's being cast on the surface of the albumen print, although this is low quality right here on the web, it will be better quality. You can really start understanding the nuances of when I take this piece of paper out and I see that this ink on this paper is much glossier than the paper itself, and I tilt it in and out of the light. Well, that's what you'll see through these videos, so it should be really helpful. So also, here's a Woodbury type. It has very different characteristics to the albumen print, but I wanted to show you what's possible. With the Woodbury type, you'd look for differential gloss between the very dense areas of the image, and also you would want to look at the surface cracking happening on the image. So this is really a lot closer to how we experience things. The digital sample book now with 20 different views where you can zoom in and out and look at raking light and axial, that's still very helpful in certain circumstances when you really want to know the details of your object. But for the identification task, the simplified views and also the kind of individual methodologies for print ID can really help. Let me go back to PowerPoint quickly. And then finally, with the albumen print, you want to look at it closer underneath some sort of magnification, either a 10x loop or a stereo microscope, to see if you can see paper fibers on the surface. Because the paper fibers, what that tells you is it's a two-layer print. So it's a piece of paper with albumen. It's essentially egg white with a silver image. And because you can see the paper fibers, it's indicating that there's no other surface layer that's been spread or coated onto the paper that disrupts that or obscures that. So the 30x magnification is really, really key for this process and understanding. You know, 30x magnification may not be important to understanding that you have a postcard and that it's an offset lithograph. You know, because with the offset lithograph, you want to be a little bit lower magnification, say under a 10x loop, that help you understand the pattern of the image. So you want to look out for the like Rosetta pattern, which would help you define it. It is that material. So, and then finally, like I mentioned earlier, we want to bring more context and historical and technological information to the sample. So through the website, you'll be able to go and read short histories of the processes. As well as we hope to be working with the George Eastman House and the archive there to, when we show you example, what's up on the screen is I believe these are Carbo prints, we'll also be able to show you some fine masterpieces from their collection as well, just to show you how these processes are used not only in the everyday but also in the arts. So we've got a huge future at IPI. Right now we're focusing on the website, the Graphics Atlas version with the identification tool. We're also, at some point, we'd like to explore some more automation and quantification using digital image processing, and do some further research on the 20th century silver gelatin print. As you know, with silver gelatin prints, which Gowan will talk about here in a little bit, there's such a huge diversity of appearance that can happen. So not only from the different surface qualities, you know, you can have papers that look like albumen prints. You know, back to that two-layer idea, it's just paper. Well, it's not albumen this time, it's gelatin and then a silver image, but they have a very similar appearance. You can also have papers that, you know, look like many of the other 19th century processes, and there's a greater diversity there. So I think it's important to not kind of put all these processes into kind of one bucket. You know, it's not just a silver gelatin print. There's a lot of diversity there, and you guys can very well see that. Also, some further research into chromogenic color prints that my colleague Gowan and another colleague of mine, Zach Long, have been working on. So we want to explore chromogenic color in greater detail. Maybe at some point there could be some sort of printed bound version of an atlas for all graphic objects. Because with our website, you can see that it's not just about photography anymore. It's about situating photography in the grand continuum of all printed graphics. And so we really have to start covering the pre-photographic materials and the digital materials to do that. It really builds a better understanding of what photography is, what it meant, what it means now. And then finally, we have to give more workshops and seminars on the topic of print identification. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. Let's see here. So, from the, let's see if we can adjust this a little bit. From the very broad picture of the entire history of photomechanical and photographic and post-photographic processes, I'm just going to look at gelatin silver prints. There is, as Ryan was saying, far too much to them to cover everything, particularly in a half an hour. And I'm going to be dealing with deterioration. But of course, in order to deal with that, I have to touch on a few other bases relative to how they're made and what they are. So I'll be presenting a guide to fiber-based gelatin silver print condition and deterioration. I wrote this guide last year as a fellow with the George Eastman House and at the Image Permanence Institute. The fiber-based gelatin silver print was the form of virtually all 20th century fine art photography. In fact, until the color revolution of the 1960s, nearly every photograph, from snapshots to exhibition prints, were fiber-based gelatin silver prints. These prints are present in large numbers, not only in fine art collections, but in archives, historical societies, and family photograph collections. The ability to understand and evaluate the condition and deterioration of these prints are vital aspects of their appreciation and care. But their condition can be described in many different ways. Prints are often said to be warm-toned, or to have silver mirroring, or a patina. But what do we mean when we use these words? What kind of aging process, physical change, or deterioration are we really describing? What is their cause? What do they say about the history of a print? And perhaps more importantly, what do they say about the future of a print? The purpose of this guide is to answer these questions and to make the examination of black and white prints more informative and rewarding. So this guide is written for anyone who cares about gelatin silver prints, whether as an archivist or a collector or a curator or a conservator. It's currently available as a PDF, and I'll give a URL at the end for that. But it should be available in print form in the first half of next year. The guide begins with brief explanations on the physical nature of gelatin silver prints and a history of their processing and stability. But at the heart of the guide is a means to understand how and why deterioration manifests. The main part of the guide covers the basic concepts of deterioration, while a section I've called Pathways, and here's one on the screen, can be consulted for greater detail. In addition, there are six sidebars throughout the text which tell deterioration stories or highlight important aspects or just interesting aspects of deterioration. We'll begin by looking at the layers of a typical gelatin silver print. It's composed of four layers, paper base, a baryta, an image layer, and an overcoat. The paper base is simply the support, of course, for the layers on top of it. The baryta layer is a mixture of white powder called barium sulfate and gelatin, which simply hides the paper fibers, provides a smooth surface for the image layer on top, and also a nice white reflective layer so that you can actually see the image. The image layer goes on top of that, which is simply the silver particles bound in a relatively clear gelatin binder. And then there's this little overcoat, which you don't really see or hear much about typically, but it's just a slightly harder version of the same gelatin from the image layer, and it provides better abrasion resistance for the kind of a protective coating on the surface. So we've come to the first of two sidebars, which discuss the size and color of silver particles and the color of gelatin. The first one discusses the physical nature of photographic silver. Silver is a precious metal with the white lustrous appearance that we see in silver jewelry or silverware or silver bullion if we worked at the Kodak vault shown here, the Kodak silver vault. In photography, however, it appears quite differently. Instead of a large mass of polished metal, the silver that composes the image in a black and white print is present as very small particles ranging about half a micrometer in diameter. These particles are often filamentary, composed of long strands of silver tangled together. At this size, the particles of silver absorb light very evenly across the visible spectrum, so they generally appear black or in shades of gray, depending upon their density, how close together the many silver particles are. But as the particles get smaller, whether by design or through decay, they lose their neutral tone. So warm-toned papers, which you often see, are manufactured with additives in the emulsion to restrain the growth of those silver crystals and the resulting silver particles in the final image. And as prints decay, as I was mentioning, the silver atoms can migrate away from these larger filamentary silver particles, gradually creating many smaller silver particles in place of the original larger grain. This causes a gradual warming of the image, as well as fading, since the smaller particles appear more yellow and sometimes can't be seen at all. The color of silver also changes when it reacts with chemicals in its environment to form new compounds such as silver sulfide. This can occur intentionally during toning, or over time as the silver image reacts with chemicals in the air such as hydrogen sulfide. When it occurs over time, the silver grains tend to disperse into smaller particles, causing image fading. In contrast, toning causes an immediate reaction that maintains the larger particle size. The silver particles are made more robust, or can be made more robust through this toning process, either by partially converting them to silver sulfide, or silver selenide in the case of selenium toning, or by partially replacing the silver with a less reactive metal like gold. Given all these different factors, particle size, chemical changes, toning, the causes of color in a print can be very difficult to explain. Even the best theories don't always account for everything that we see. But subtle differences in the way print ages can give clues to its history and the reasons for how it looks today. Sidebar 2, what makes a print yellow, discusses the color of the gelatin binder, as it is so important in the viewing of the image. Gelatin forms the matrix in which the silver image is suspended, and its clarity and transparency are a very important part of the viewing process. In fact, it's doubly important, since as this diagram shows, the light must travel through the gelatin layer twice to reach your eye, kind of multiplying the effect of any yellowing. Gelatin is slightly yellow in color, as you can see in this kind of pile of dried gelatin flakes, though this isn't really noticeable on a print where the gelatin is highly refined, the coating is extremely thin, and dyes are often used in that baryta layer to offset the slight natural yellowing of the gelatin. However, the yellowing can become visible as the gelatin ages. Chromophores, portions of a molecule that are responsible for color, can develop in the gelatin as a result of contact with poor quality paper materials, for example. These contain lignans, which I'm sure you hear a lot about and otherwise think about a lot as archivists, and other components that have been shown to produce yellowing when in proximity to a photograph. And this is one of the reasons why good quality enclosures are generally recommended for the storage of photographs. I'm not going to talk about this in any length at all, but I talk about it in greater detail in the guide. Gelatin silver prints, the kind of history of it, they were first really made in the 1870s, but on more of kind of a one-off basis. In the 1880s, they started making them commercially on continuous coating machines for the first time. So that's when you really start to see kind of a more serious commercial production of them. But at first, they were in the 1880s and the 1890s. They're still very, very matte, and those early prints are they're kind of obvious that they're very early prints when you see them. Once you've seen a few of them, you don't really get the glossier look till even the 20s or the 30s. So that's all I'll say here, but there's a lot of fascinating history to that. But I'll look in slightly more detail at the history of processing and image stability, since we're talking about deterioration here. Processing has played a major role over the last 100 years in the stability of black and white prints, but concerns about the fading of silver-based photographs can be traced back to the beginnings of photography. In the 1840s, William Henry Fox Talbot's prints became so famous for their fading that a cartoon and poem published under the heading Photographic Failures appeared in the magazine Punch in 1846. The fading of these salted paper prints, which are silver but not quite gelatin yet, was often blamed on residual fixer. I'm sure you've heard that explanation for the deterioration of black and white prints. This was sometimes due to an intentional lack of washing that was done to achieve deep purple or brown tints in these early photographs. But this improved color came at the expense of longevity, for the images soon faded to a pale yellow. The problem of fading was severe enough that the Photographic Society of London set up a committee to address the issue in 1855. Later in that same year, they published their first report citing moisture in the presence of residual fixer and or hydrogen sulfide as the basic reason for all fading. And they weren't that far off. In addition, a majority of the committee was of the opinion that gold toning significantly improved image stability. People have been much more wrong about this topic since then. Hydrogen sulfide is a product of the combustion of coal gas, and was pervasive in industrialized 19th century London. Hydrogen sulfide and other pollutants that are harmful to photographic prints can be found everywhere in varying concentrations. Since it wasn't practical, particularly in London, to remove such contaminants, attention was turned to the removal of fixer. Perhaps turned too hard to the removal of fixer. Numerous methods and chemicals are recorded in the photographic literature over the next 100 years for the elimination of fixer, culminating in the 1940s, when the Kodak Research Laboratories officially recommended the complete elimination treatment for all black and white photographic materials. This consisted of Kodak's hypo-eliminator solutions, which oxidized the remaining fixer into harmless sulfates. This extreme measure was based on the belief that even the minutest quantity of fixer remaining in the photograph would cause image fading. But in the 1960s, about 25 years later, they figured something else out, and no one had thought about this before. A small amount of fixer left in a print actually forms a protective coating of silver sulfide, because there's sulfur in sodium thiosulfate. And it kind of acts as a mildly protective toner. And overwashing can actually leave the silver in the print more vulnerable to deterioration. For example, an overwashed print might look something like this after exposure to a normal urban atmosphere. The print shows no particular signs of poor processing, but it's quite faded. But we'll get to that later. Since there was no way to know in practice exactly how much fixer was left in a print, the recommendation has simply become to wash for the recommended times, but not to overwash. I don't have time to address the subject of toning in any great detail here. Suffice it to say that sepia or sulfur toning, such as this photograph of George Eastman, is essentially bulletproof from a deterioration point of view. The silver sulfide that forms the image in these prints is nearly indestructible. It's an extremely stable compound. It was very popular in the 1920s and 1930s, though it was used predominantly for portraiture. Selenium toning, famously championed by Ansel Adams in this century or last century, was widely used in the 20th century by fine art photographers and could be used with little or no change in image color, perhaps one of the main reasons for its popularity. Now for the actual deterioration, though, which I've organized into a chart for easy reference. The chart is color-coded by three general types of deterioration. Image decay, shown here, as well as gelatin binder and paper decay and mechanical damage further down the chart. The column on the left shows the type of deterioration, followed by the corresponding pathway, and then the location of the deterioration. Often location is the key to differentiating between similar types of deterioration. The thumbnails on the right are a quick reference for each type of deterioration, and they all come from a larger photograph elsewhere in the guide. The second portion of the chart shows gelatin binder and paper decay, and very briefly, mechanical damage. We'll now examine a few of these categories, no time for all of them, starting with image decay. And this begins with a sidebar on the primary factors in image stability. There are five factors that influence the long-term stability of the silver image: water, air pollutants, heat, processing and toning, and particle size. And very briefly, water in the form of atmospheric humidity can swell the gelatin, or does swell the gelatin, and allows for easier penetration of air pollutants. And it also, remember we saw those silver ions very briefly before kind of migrating away from the silver particles. Well, when there's more water around and the gelatin is more swollen, it turns out that those particles can migrate. If it's drier, they tend to not be able to migrate so much. So that's water is very key in that process. Air pollutants such as hydrogen sulfide or nitrogen dioxide in the atmosphere react with the silver image to cause fading and yellowing. Heat supplies more energy for these deterioration reactions. Processing and toning determine the composition and chemical environment of the image particles. Fixing and washing, as I discussed briefly, may leave the silver particles either only slightly protected or vulnerable to deterioration or highly prone to yellowing. Proper processing followed by sulfur toning is perhaps the most effective means, though not aesthetically pleasing to all, while selenium and gold toning can also offer some protection. Particle size plays an important role. Most developed out black and white papers, gelatin silver prints, those are synonymous, have silver particles, as I said, ranging about a half a micrometer in diameter. That's about 1/160th of the width of a human hair. So slower speed papers, such as contact printing papers or printing out papers, have even smaller particles, often like 1/100th of the diameter, approximately. And these have much greater surface area in total because of they have many smaller particles, and therefore much more area to react, and so they're often more susceptible to decay. Given all these image stability factors, a well-processed print would remain unchanged for a very long time if it was kept in a cool, moderately dry, and perfectly inert environment without exposure to any airborne pollutants. Sulfide toners can have a similar effect by converting the silver into the very stable compound silver sulfide, like the portrait of Mr. Eastman, and even the abuse suffered by this print that I found at a flea market has done almost nothing to the image because it was sepia toned or sulfur toned. Again, same thing. However, in real life, there are very few perfect environments, and not many prints are sulfur-toned. So in real life, in your archive, for example, deterioration of the image proceeds by exposure to pollutants in the presence of moisture and heat. The basic mechanism of silver image decay is the same in every case. The silver particles that form the image undergo changes in their shape and size and may react with sulfur to form silver sulfide. The change in particle size and the reaction of the sulfur can produce dramatic changes in the color and density of the silver image. Take, for example, this print of a powerhouse mechanic by Lewis Hine, which might begin looking like this and could eventually look like this. These are two different prints. Now look carefully at what has happened. The highlights have faded and lost all detail. The midtones have turned yellow-brown. Let's back up. Even the shadows have been affected, becoming more yellow-brown. What's happening to the silver? Let's look at this deterioration at the level of the individual filament. This is a silver filament. You add oxidizing agent, which could be any number of pollutants and even oxygen in some situations. This oxidizes metallic silver to silver ions, which are capable of traveling through the gelatin, and they do, radiating in all directions away from the filament. Now assume there is a source of sulfur in the air as well. The sulfur reacts with the silver ions to make silver sulfide. And depending on the size and density of the particles, silver sulfide can be invisible, very, very small particles, yellow, medium size, or brown, larger and more dense. So now consider the, here's our silver sulfide. Now consider the powerhouse mechanic again. The highlights have faded, the midtones are yellow, and the shadows are brown. This is the most common form of deterioration that you see all the time, but of course there are other possibilities. For a number of reasons, the sulfiding reaction may occur only around the edges of a print, such as on this Edward Weston, where only the edges have turned a yellow-brown and faded slightly, the classic appearance of sulfiding. The best explanation for the preferential fading at the edge of this print is that it is caused by air pollutants. The physical relationship between the print and the surrounding air is such that the edges are exposed to a higher dose of pollutants. The cut edge may also, and it's sometimes explained this way, give pollutants easier access to the silver image along the edges, though no one's really shown that to be the case for certain. What if the pollutant was a peroxide, such as that given off by fresh oil-based paint or varnish? And I'll tell you a story, and that begins, and which is told in sidebar 4, heat, humidity, paint fumes, and the benefits of toning. A well-processed and untoned gelatin silver print is a fragile object. Untoned silver particles have a great deal of surface area and are very eager to react. Discoloration that is simply the result of this fragility is often blamed on poor processing, but this is not usually the case. In the late 1990s, a New York City photographer's work was exhibited in a non-climate-controlled gallery during a particularly hot and humid summer. The prints were carefully processed but not toned, and the photographer had never had any problems with her work before. During the show, however, yellow-orange discoloration appeared along the edges in the light midtones. The photographer consulted with IPI in Rochester to understand the cause and develop a solution. Selenium toning was chosen for its ability to both provide protection to the silver image. We're on the right slide here. To provide both protection to the silver image and retain the print's tonal aesthetic. One of the untoned prints was hung in a darkroom, and several years later, when the darkroom was being repainted, the painter failed to remove the print from the wall prior to painting as he was instructed. The print was finally removed after several hours exposure to fresh oil-based paint fumes, but it was too late. Within days, the yellow-orange edge discoloration had extended into the midtones across the entire photograph. What had begun by exposure to heat, humidity, and New York City air was dramatically increased by a more concentrated dose of pollutants. Identical effects have been seen on prints by Richard Avedon that were stored in crates soon after the interior of the crates were sealed with varnish. You might see similar effects in your archives if prints and fresh paint were mixed at some point in the past. While toning will increase the resistance of silver to such attacks, a combination of toning and proper environment is really necessary. In the guide, I go into some detail on how this type of deterioration occurs at the level of the silver filament, and also how silver mirroring takes place and why these things occur at the edges or overall or only in the shadows and so on. Speaking of only in the shadows, for example, on this Stieglitz print, which if we look at in specular light, we change our lighting, as Ryan was emphasizing the importance of. We can observe the effect of the silver particles, which as they were migrating in all directions, inevitably also migrated to the surface. And once they reached there, they kind of plated out on that surface, forming kind of a mirror. While moisture, heat, and pollutants will always harm a print, processing also has a profound effect. Processing can have obviously beneficial effects, as in the case of many toning treatments, and it can also contribute to rapid deterioration. Poor processing is insufficient fixing or washing that results in silver fixer compounds being left in the print. Over time, the fixer decomposes, reacts to the silver, and causes yellow-brown staining. This can occur locally, such as when fixer-contaminated fingers touch the print, presumably just after processing, which might look something like the Western print shown here. The automatic assumption that yellowing or fading of a silver image is due to inadequate fixing or washing, however, is deeply embedded in the photographic literature, but obscures the real complexity of the issue. For example, poor processing can also be shown in a case like this, where prints were laying on top of one another during fixing or washing, which is obvious when they only partially overlap, and the yellow-brown discoloration occurs in the shape of the other print, such as on this hind. And this brings up an interesting point. Theoretically, if silver fixer compounds from poor processing are to blame, then a print that was not washed well enough should have silver fixer compounds across the entire print, including in the non-image areas. This would result in yellowing in non-image areas, such as the border of this hind print, and the presence of such yellowing should immediately indicate poor processing. Look at this print, for example. There's yellowing along the bottom edge, but it's very subtle, and if there was no border, or if the stain was overall, it would be very difficult to determine the cause. For example, here are a couple of Stieglitz's equivalents. No borders, there is nothing in the print on the right that we can be sure is supposed to be completely white without silver. There is no obvious indicator for a particular cause. We know that it's discolored. We understand the basic mechanism of sulfiding that led to this discoloration, but why did it occur? Rubber cement on the verso, bad storage conditions, poor processing. And even if we know that there is yellowing in the non-image area, there's another complication. Is it yellowing of the gelatin or of the image silver or both? Deterioration is complex, and there are always several factors that contribute to the current state of a print. In the end, the cause can sometimes be very difficult to know with certainty, though a full understanding of deterioration and a bit of detective work with the print in front of you may yield many clues. And of course, no matter the cause, the care of the print is the same, cool and moderately dry. We've come to the end of the image decay category. I didn't cover every contingency or explain every form of it, but I covered some of the major ones. If there's one image decay concept, though, that I hope everyone will take away, and this can't be stressed enough, it is that processing yields prints with varying degrees of resistance to deterioration across a broad spectrum, from nearly bulletproof, when a print is sulfur tone, for example, to very susceptible to decay, such as an improperly washed or fixed print. And between these two extremes is an infinite number of variations in the size, composition, and chemical environment of the silver particles, which predisposes them to be relatively stable or relatively unstable in the face of the widely varying conditions, pollutants, temperature, humidity, etc., that we expose them to. The next major category is gelatin binder and paper decay, and for time reasons, I really won't cover that in any significant detail at all. But it includes deterioration that occurs as a result of disasters, such as this nitrate fire at the George Eastman House in 1978, which the fire was put out, and as often happens with these things, more of the damage was due to water than fire, and there was a number of traveling exhibition crates in the little barn structure right next door that were thoroughly wetted and produced stains like this, which can still be found in the Eastman House archives today. Age, deterioration, or patina is one of the last sections of the guide and deals with deterioration and its effects on value in the fine art market. And I think this is one of the places where deterioration can become particularly interesting. The visible signs of age are valued just as a vintage print is preferred over a later print. While the aging of a print is certainly a form of decay, the line between deterioration and patina is often drawn by aesthetics rather than science. Deterioration is often interpreted as a sign of authenticity, and as long as it does not disfigure the image, it is also often valued and called patina. This photograph of Winston Churchill is a good example. It's, although sometimes hard to tell in a digital projection, it is slightly warm-toned, which is not really typical of Karsh's prints. The warmth is a result of deterioration. Though subtle and charming, the corners are a little bit dog-eared. There's some mirroring along the edges, though you can't see it in this particular lighting. What if we take the warm tone a little further? Warm tone gelatin silver prints is an oft-used term today in the fine art market, which can refer to both tone prints and prints worn by the sulfiding of time. In this case, the very distinct yellowing of the highlights and mid-tones seems to fit the subject, even to the degree that many observers don't even realize that this is deterioration. Silver mirroring is another form of deterioration that we often see in black and white prints. It's equally regarded as a sign of authenticity. Subtle mirroring, or mirroring that enhances an image, is highly valued, and the story behind this particular print is simply that it showed up at auction in the late 90s. It sold for a very nice price for that print. It showed up a few years later with the mirroring removed, and it didn't sell. So these things can dramatically affect the value of a print. Everyone, to conclude, not quite yet. To conclude, everyone has a slightly different reason for looking. Some want to know when the print was made. Others are interested in how it was made, or perhaps simply in better understanding its current condition. The collector might wish to discriminate between deterioration and original intent, while the conservator must understand more precisely the material or chemical nature of the deterioration in order to safely and more effectively carry out a treatment. As archivists, you are often responsible for large collections, and preventing further deterioration is a fundamental aspect of your work. For all of you, a greater awareness of deterioration, I hope, will illuminate the consequences of neglect, not necessarily your own, and help you to set guidelines for the storage and handling of your collections. So the 20th century is over. Gelatin silver prints are really fundamentally now an alternative process. It's time to review our understanding of these artifacts, and I think deterioration is a critical aspect of this understanding. Thanks for your attention, and thanks to those who helped me in my research. So, you want to come up, Ryan? So, it's 9. Question?
On a tangent subject, what's the current thought on preservation of digital images?
That's a very good question. And like gelatin silver prints or any number of other things, digital prints are not one thing. There's a fairly wide variety of them.
Not so much the prints, but electronically. CD, DVD, Ooh. Keep it on the computer, a flash card.
I would say that would be a topic for a different session in this building. Many people are discussing it, and I wouldn't want to impinge upon their thoughts on the matter.
What is your thought?
It depends on the situation. It totally depends on just who you are and what you're doing.
On the title of this seminar, that's what I thought we were getting into.
No, we're not. Okay. It's a favorite subject of mine, but not one I'm discussing today.
Thanks.
Any questions? Yeah.
When you're talking about oil-based paint and off-gassing, what about latex paint? Is it the same kind of situation to be concerned about?
It's not so much a problem these days. And no, the latex paints don't cause the same kind of off-gassing and the same kind of deterioration mechanisms. So in general today, there's been a pretty significant movement away from those oil-based paints in recent times. And it's not so much a problem, but when you're painting a dark room or you're painting a bathroom, or a kitchen, or, you know, there's certain, and certain, just certain types of paints, some of the varnish, some of the oil-based varnishes, they can, even though they're not supposed to be around, these things keep on popping up. So I would stay on the safe side. But no, in general, not a problem.
Yeah. In Hawaii, they use Vicarin a lot for heating our houses, and they assure us that Vicarin will not damage photographs. However, it is known to damage silver, and I'm just curious if you have had any reason to encounter Vicarin.
Only in my very early years in conservation, when I was more interested in objects at the time, actually. And so I haven't really ever looked at the interaction of silver photographs and Vicarin. But if you contact me afterwards, I'd be happy to think about it a little further. Yeah.
In our collections, we have some prints that were taken by photographers and institutions that were, I think they were dip washed. Quickly for publication for the newsletters, mm-hmm. and they're massively stained on the recto and verso, you know, through the paper.
Yeah, those.
In some cases, I've just reproduced those and actually disposed of them. I mean, the chemistry is, the smell is really heavy.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if it's always wise to do that or isolate them from other collections.
I've never seen they're generally called stabilization prints, and it was a very quick process. It was a developer incorporated papers that were just put through it. They could be processed from dry to dry in like 1 minute, I think. Used a lot in the press, newspaper industry, and so forth. There are ways of going about that. I won't go into the details right now, but I'm happy to talk to you about it. But I've never seen any data on them affecting other photographs, though I wouldn't want to put them in direct contact with a photograph I liked, certainly. And there are ways of going about kind of reprocessing them, more or less, to kind of try to slow down their further deterioration and so forth. But you want to be careful about just going and washing them, because that destabilizes them, and then they start turning strange colors and darkening even more rapidly. So you have to be careful.
From an appraisal,
you know. I won't condone that one way or the other. But I'm happy to talk to you about it in more detail.
Good.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I think certain functions will come sooner than others. So the identification tool, I think we're heavily working on that right now. And the new interface for the digital sample book now, which we're calling the Object Explorer. I think I foresee those being out there on the web, who knows, within the next 6 months or so. But the history and technology pages are, you got to imagine with this type of research, we need to get the right people involved for that. And so, you know, two or three of us really can't do a good job at fully writing the history of all printed objects, but maybe if we find the right people, we can definitely have some good contributions to further that end of it.
We should also just mention in this context that the this project of the digital sample book / graphics atlas, as well as a project that's on the kind of connoisseurship, connoisseurship wiki, for lack of a better name at this point, at the George Eastman House, are all kind of combining into a much larger project called the Center for the Legacy of Photography that's beginning late next year. So this will kind of become part of that and will certainly continue, but deadlines are hard.
I think certain aspects of this could kind of merge together with the Center for the Legacy of Photography, and like I mentioned before, part of our mission is to help place photography into the grand continuum of all printed objects. And so we're working on that through the resource.
Yeah.
You don't talk about resin-coated paper. And I find that when I'm working with community people, they simply do not know the difference between fiber-based paper and resin-coated paper. And also, I'm going to give you my card, but we've been working from a disaster of aerial photographs that we've discovered a paper called BIMAT.
BIMAT?
Yeah, do you know BIMAT?
No.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, no, RC prints, if it was just a matter of a different support, I would go into more detail on it. But unfortunately, because of that different support, they deteriorate in entirely different ways. I mean, some of the basic mechanisms are the same, but the look is completely different. And there are some new fun mechanisms that come up when you introduce the polyethylene support. So, yeah, that's why I don't deal with it. Not for the purposes of this particular guide. There has been a significant amount of research that's gone into coatings on photographs. In fact, there was a book published several years ago in 2005, I believe, on coatings on photographs. And that includes many references to the practice of various photographers, including the Westons and Strand and Ansel Adams and so forth, and their coating practices. We don't see a lot of problems from an image deterioration, from a silver image deterioration point of view from those, generally speaking. I certainly don't address it in any detail here. Any other questions? Thank you very much.